Uber's CEO is taking an indefinite leave of absence. Tim Cook says that Apple is working on the brains, the AI brains of your future self-driving car. Verizon has completed its takeover of Yahoo, and it's going to combine Yahoo with AOL. All that and more on today's episode of Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1788, recorded Tuesday, June 13th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three free meals with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today, the show where we talk about some of the biggest stories in tech and some of the most interesting and passionate people in technology. I'm Nathan Olivares-Giles.
And evidently, according to the TriCaster, I am Podrizzle.
I guess that's what you can call him.
That's what I am today.
So we're filling in for Megan Maroney and Jason Howell. They will be back tomorrow. But there is so much news to get to. We're going to start, of course, it seems like the last few days we've been starting with Uber. Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, is officially taking a leave of absence. In a note to employees sent Tuesday, Kalanick said he will take time to, quote, work on himself and reflect on building a world-class leadership team. The CEO will also be focusing on family after the tragic death of his mother in a recent boating accident. The decision, which Uber says is the CEO's on his own, comes as the company is dealing with the ongoing fallout from reports of a toxic company culture rife with widespread sexual harassment and corporate misbehavior. More than 20 people have been let go in connection to sexual harassment claims at the company. Two top executives below Kalanick have left the company recently, and this leave of absence is indefinite, so we're not quite sure when he will return.
It's interesting because more and more news keeps coming out about Uber, and almost none of it is good. In fact, the only thing that could be kind of good was the fact that instead of losing $1 something billion the last quarter, they only lost $700 million.
Yeah.
That qualifies as good news in the Uber world right now, because it is just story after story about bad culture, bad behavior, bad decisions, bad leadership. At one point, you got to say, well, how much more can Uber take?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And, you know, they're not a publicly traded company right now. Right. But if they ever do have IPO aspirations, which you would think a company at this size would, and in order to do the sort of things that their ambition is reaching for, like developing self-driving car technology and offering automation and all sorts of things like this, they'll have to do that someday. But before you would ever try to sell investors on Wall Street on your company, you have to sell consumers. Yep. And building your brand. And right now that brand is pretty much, as you said, kind of defined by the bad news that's happening there. Interestingly enough, though, as they're really trying to embrace this culture shift and they're, you know, getting rid of a lot of the leadership, bringing in new folks, the CEO isn't going to be around. This seems like one of the most important points for the company. And he's leaving. Now, there are many good reasons, both personal and professional, that he would be taking a leave of absence. But it seems like a very important inflection point for the company. So it should be a very different company when he gets back. Interestingly enough, they hired former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to basically do an evaluation of the company's culture and make some recommendations on what should be changed. 13 pages of that report were released today as well. And in it, the former attorney general recommends to limit Kalanick's responsibilities, hire a strong chief operating officer to run the day-to-day of the company, and appoint an independent board chairman, and create an oversight committee on the board, all in an effort to bolster the checks and balances on management. So it definitely seems like a lot of the, you know, finger pointing is going back to the top leadership.
You know, this is actually not a surprise. We do have a saying in my other line of work that a religious order never flourishes until its founder's dead. And it's a bit of logic that does apply, because think about it. What do we know about Uber? Uber it's disruptive, right? Mm-hmm. It did a great job of that. It really shook up the whole taxi market. It made cities look at how they're handling transportation for its citizens. And in that sense, that they're a pirate. And that's it's good to be a pirate. However, every company that starts out as disruptive, starts out as that pirate company, has to grow up.
Exactly.
At some point, they become a publicly traded company. They have stockholders. They have a board. They have people they're responsible to. And so that same sort of disruptive, at a glance, off the cuff, almost frat boy mentality goes from being the thing that drives your disruptive behavior to something that's just disruptive to your company.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where Uber is right now. That's the spot that they find themselves. And either they grow up and they become the company that can be disruptive into the future, or it becomes a footnote of, hey, you remember Uber? Yeah, they started this motion towards self-driving cars and a different way of looking at taxis, and now they're gone.
Yeah, and there was another report from Yahoo today. They had and someone leaked to them a recording of an all-hands meeting where they're going over the Holder report, and Arianna Huffington, who's on the board, was explaining everything to folks, and she said, hey, I'm the only woman on the board. We just got this Nestle executive. She's going to join the board. They say it's easier to get a second woman on the board if you already have one, and we're seeing progress in diversifying the board. One of the male board members spoke up and said, actually, when you have a woman on the board, data shows that you get more talking on the board. So it's like in the middle of an all hands meeting, you're seeing these sorts of comments that are cringeworthy. And so it's just a fantastic example of how much work Uber still has to do. And these issues exist on their board of directors and the company as a whole. A lot of the dialogue that was happening in this meeting was actually talking to the employees and saying, hey, listen, you have to hold us accountable. You have to hold your managers accountable. You have to hold yourselves accountable. It's there's a lot of talk about, well, how do we do this together? But there's a lot of problems over there. They need to grow up, and it seems like they don't quite yet know how to do so. Even today, they're not handling it too seriously.
I mean, here's the thing. In the internet world and the internet economy, we are very good at shaming bad behavior.
Yeah.
We do it all the time, and we are exceptional at it. We are not very good at forgiving. So at some point, once someone or a company has paid its dues, it should be allowed back in, because someone who has made the mistake and corrected the mistake is actually more trustworthy. That's the person you want on your board.
Mm-hmm.
That's the person you want in your company. However, what we're seeing in Uber is, it almost seems as if they're saying this is something that's being imposed upon us because it's politically correct, but there's really nothing wrong with the culture. I mean, that was exactly what happened. That's that reason why that comment happened during that meeting,
exactly.
Which is he was saying, oh, well, I mean, there's no real reason why we're here other than this is all BS.
Yeah, yeah.
And until they can own that and say, yes, there is an issue.
Yeah.
Yes, there was a problem. We are working on it. These are the concrete steps we're taking. Then you shouldn't trust Uber.
Yeah, you can't solve a problem if you don't acknowledge the problem exists, basically, right?
Are we done dumping on Uber?
I think so.
Okay, let's dump on someone else. Now, Apple CEO Tim Cook, in an interview with Bloomberg, said the company is working on self-driving car technology, but it's not a self-driving car, as has been long speculated, but rather the brains of a self-driving car. Now, Cook didn't explicitly say what Apple's plans are or what sort of product would eventually come of its efforts, but Cook said that there are three versions of changes that are disrupting the auto industry. One, self-driving cars. Two, electric cars. And three, ride-sharing. Apple is focusing on the autonomous systems and said that the company sees a core technology that we view as very important, the mother of all AI projects, and possibly one of the most difficult AI projects there is to work on. While Cook was deliberately vague on Apple's plans and Apple's self-driving car tests and hires have been widely reported, Apple almost never speaks this early on projects that are that far away from being a releasable consumer product. Let's start with that last bit.
Mm-hmm.
Apple doesn't do vaporware.
No.
They don't. When they announce it, it's almost ready for you to buy. That's been their hallmark. People love that about them, the fact that they demo something and then you can place your pre-order.
Yeah.
This is something that is obviously years and years and years in advance. It seems strange to have the CEO of the company even commenting on it.
Yeah, it's a very un-Apple-like move. It's very it's rare. It's uncharacteristic. It's abnormal. So you got to kind of ask yourself, well, why? Who is Tim Cook trying to talk here? Why does he feel that this is important enough to speak about now? Because he's not the sort of person who just talks off the cuff or who just like lets something slide. He's calculated and very purposeful in everything he does. So is this a message to hiring talent? Is this a message to shareholders? Is this a message to automakers to say, hey, come work with us and collaborate with us? You know, I'm not quite sure. Maybe it's a message to all of those groups because they're competing with Google. They're competing with, you know, Uber. They're competing with, to a certain extent, every automaker out there. But finding out, you know, where everybody's at and then turning potential rivals into collaborators to advance what you're doing makes sense. And that's kind of what you're going to need to do here because they're not going to, you know, if they aren't going to build a car from the ground up, you know, then they're going to have to work with automakers. So it's a really interesting message. But at the same time, as you pointed out, he really didn't say that much. He just kind of said what we all knew, which is Apple's working on some self-driving car technology. So, you know, it's a really kind of fascinating move. And I'm sure there's some good reason behind it.
I think I see there being two reasons for this happening. One, I'm absolutely with you. I think this is not a mistake. This is Tim Cook essentially saying, hey, you want to work on some next-gen technology with Apple?
Yeah.
Are you good with AI? Are you good with self-driving cars? Now would be a good time to join us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that side. The other side is this actually is a little bit of damage control. So because even though the story has been speculation for years now that Apple is doing a self-driving car, I think with all the hires and then dismissals that they had in the super secretive program, it was sort of Apple saying, wow, this is way more complicated than we thought it would be. Mm-hmm. You know, this is more than a software thing. This is more than a physical design. There are literally tens of thousands of pieces that we have to put together. And there's all this liability for a product that gets way less profit margin than we're used to. And that was just so far out of its ballywick that it basically gave them a black eye. They're saying, okay, obviously we can't develop a car because that's crazy. But we can develop car software. Now we need to bring people in to actually develop that for us.
Yeah, and when that software arrives, I mean, we'll see how all these things look. But it's, you know, typically the suppliers for auto manufacturers, you don't see those brands. Yep. You buy a Ford, you don't get to see, you know, who the supplier of the brake systems were or whatever, right? And all these different parts are coming from all over the world, companies like Visteon and others. So it's interesting. You know, someday could we see an Apple logo on the side of a car or a Google logo on the side of the car? How are they going to present these partnerships once they do exist? Because they aren't a nicely packaged, you know, a shelfable or an app or something like that. You're not going to see that same sort of consumer product. It's a radically different thing. One of the things, of course, that is core to all of this and which Tim Cook really did hammer in this interview with Bloomberg was that this is an AI problem. This is an AI effort, and that's what they're going after. And Apple's approach to building out artificial intelligence is very different than Google's approach, which I'd say is probably their biggest competitor in the self-driving car space right now, in the sense that Google just kind of takes all the data they can, and they're one of those companies that will build stuff in public and just kind of make mistakes, and they'll do it right in front of you, where
you get it's refined. The product that you get from Apple is far more refined.
Yeah, but they also on the AI side, they're not taking as much data. They're not maybe offering, you know, introducing some privacy compromises to consumers in the process and those sorts of things. They're chasing the same AI problems but with a different set of data and considerations. And I'm interested to see how that informs this because this isn't about building a demographic profile on someone and then selling them an ad. This is literally about getting machines that are built from different companies talking to each other and then behaving safely on the road and then recognizing like millions of different possible obstacles and then making a decision in a split second so that they don't just like kill everybody and everything in the way.
There's another issue here, and this is a culture mismatch for Apple. Apple's key to success has always been to own the core technologies that drive their products. You've seen that in their laptops, in their desktops, in their phones, and in their tablets. That's why they start making their own chips. That's why they start making their own components, because they don't want any partner to be able to hold up what they can or cannot do with a product release. This is different. Apple, if they're just making the brains, I don't see them being happy with just allowing that to be installed in any car. They're going to demand a level of cooperation with the partners the auto manufacturers that those auto manufacturers will never accept, not when there's already competing products from Microsoft, from Google, and et cetera. So, you know, it's almost as if I'm looking at this going, I don't see a really good path for Apple to continue forward. Even if they make a killer AI, a fantastic product, they're going to demand so much from any manufacturer that wants to install it in their car that most manufacturers will just walk.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see where all this goes and how all this plays out. Well, Verizon has officially closed its $4.48 billion takeover of Yahoo. Marissa Mayer has stepped down as the Yahoo CEO, and Yahoo will be combined with AOL, which Verizon bought for $4.4 billion in 2015. Together, the two legacy tech companies will be structured as a new division of Verizon called Oath. The Yahoo and AOL brands, however, will remain on Yahoo and AOL products. So to the public, you won't even probably see or know what Oath is. AOL CEO Tim Armstrong will be the CEO of Oath. And after the combination is complete, Oath is expected to lay off about 2,100 employees, or about 15% of its workforce. Mayer, a highly praised executive at Google, became the CEO of Yahoo 8 years ago, promising to turn Yahoo back into a major player in tech, and that never panned out. But she did still make many shareholders happy while she was the CEO of Yahoo's Yahoo. The company's market cap rose $18 billion to $51 billion in total.
$4.8 billion.
Yep.
Do you remember, less than a decade ago, Microsoft made a bid for Yahoo for $44.3 billion?
Yeah.
And they said, no, that's way too low.
Yeah. Yeah. If you look at it in many different ways, they missed out and they could have had something much more. But, you know, at that time, Yahoo might not have been so far behind on so many, you know, trends in what consumers do with tech and social networking and cloud and providing services. And
Yahoo was still very much a shotgun approach back then. They had so many products out there, so many different companies that they had acquired, that it was kind of a mess. But even when Microsoft made that offer, there were people, including myself, reporting on this, saying that's way too much money. Because we're looking at, and remember, part of that was all of the stock that they owned in
Alibaba.
In Alibaba.
Yep.
So they were buying that as well.
Yeah.
But people were looking at the core Yahoo technology saying, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a little bit of digital advertising. We made a partnership with you for the search engine, but other than that, you're an empty coat.
Yeah, yeah.
And even then, Yang, he took it and he was gloating. He said, "Yeah, I put a poison pill into the deal, to kill it off." And shareholders went along with him, thinking, "Okay, well, he knows what's best." They just lost them billions and billions and billions of dollars in sale.
Yeah, it's a really kind of a fascinating history for this company, and especially with AOL. Tim Armstrong a couple years ago was asked to define like what AOL was as a company, and he had a hard time saying exactly what the company did. Yahoo CEOs were asked the same questions over the year before, and even during Mayer's tenure, and no one could ever say, are they a content maker, are they an app maker, like what do they do? You know, what exactly is the thing that you are? And
they don't know.
And it's always been a difficult question to answer. Now, combining AOL and Yahoo, you know, these two companies have kind of been punchlines for a really long time. Despite being big, despite having millions and millions of users that have stuck with them for so long.
On accident, it's just because people still don't know that they have an AOL account that they're paying for every month.
It does kind of make me wonder, like, what other, you know, tarnished legacy companies could you get? Could you go and get?
So they've got AOL, they've got Yahoo. Verizon needs to go for MySpace. If they get MySpace, then that's
nailed
it.
Nailed it. That's
those
what I was
three
thinking.
Pieces.
That would be kind of perfect. That would be kind of the perfect trifecta of like, does anybody want to use that company anymore? But nonetheless, there are still millions of people who use Yahoo's homepage, their news services, their weather apps, their ad platform, and services like Tumblr and Flickr. It's worth noting, though, that Yahoo has been one of the worst with protecting their consumer data, and they've had breaches on massive scales, some of the biggest in tech. It seems like just about, you know, every year for like the last 3 or 4 years.
And not only that, those breaches have shown something that's very distressing, or at least should be distressing for anyone who's looking over this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, when they had the breaches, they were big. I mean, you're talking about a billion users.
Yeah.
But the effect, the fallout, wasn't really big.
Yeah.
And what that tells me is those accounts were all inactive. Nobody cared. They were abandoned. Oof. They were third, fourth, fifth accounts,
yeah.
Which tells me you're not really buying anything. This is not where people are engaging. So for me, even that 4.48 billion, that's too high. That's, I mean, no.
You know, if I had that much, I don't think I'd be spending on that, but I'm not Verizon. You know, the one thing for Verizon is that really this is an part of an ongoing effort, and you're seeing it from Verizon. You're seeing it from AT&T with buying DirecTV. You see it, you know, from Comcast and all these different companies. They don't want to be just a set of dumb pipes
right.
that data gets fed through. They want to control some content. They want to, you know, be both a company that makes the things that get shoveled through their pipes and the company that owns the pipes. So this is just, you know, part of a continuing effort for Verizon on that point.
Which is also troubling because that sort of vertical integration, which we've yeah. seen with Comcast, NBC,
yeah.
that leads to so much conflict of interest because now we start talking about zero rating, which Verizon wants
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, we would have protections from that if we kept net neutrality in place, which but of course won't. The FCC doesn't want to do that.
Right.
So, yep.
So, good luck, I guess is what we're saying. All right, let's go ahead and move on. Now, the Russian cyber attacks on the U.S. electoral system during the last presidential election was much bigger than previously believed. According to a Bloomberg report, Russian hackers hit voter databases and software systems in a total of 39 states, twice as many as previously reported. In Illinois, investigators find evidence that Russian intruders tried to delete or alter voter data. The attacks took place over a time period spanning last summer and fall. And the scope and sophistication of the attacks was such that the Obama administration reached out directly to the Kremlin in Moscow to complain about the meddling. As a direct result of those actions last fall, the Department of Homeland Security created and sent special teams around the country to help states strengthen their cybersecurity efforts. That was in addition to some states hiring third-party private security companies as well. So this is not going away. This is not a story that is a one-stop shop because we're seeing it still.
Yeah, just as more and more information is trickling about Uber, it seems like almost every day, it seems like every week or two, we're hearing more about Russian hackers meddling in our election. And the full scope of it doesn't really seem to be fully understood at this point. You know, with this report saying that, about twice as many states were affected as previously believed. I mean, that's a big difference.
It goes from being, there were a few isolated cases to, the vast majority mm-hmm. of states had some sort of tampering that was attempted.
Yeah.
Now, okay, the reports have to continue on to see exactly what did happen. It probably would not have changed the results of the election. But they have to remember, there's so much fatigue around the story right now.
Yeah.
Because, Russians. This is different. There mm-hmm. there was two hacks of the election. One was information peddling mm-hmm, and bundling mm-hmm. real information with fake information
yep.
in order to confuse people. That's the part that people have heard about. This is separate.
This is the part that doesn't get as much attention. And yeah, at this point, we don't know whether or not
yep.
this meddling impacted the election. And at this point, most law enforcement agencies and government entities have said that they don't believe that it changed the outcome, right?
Right, right.
So in a sense, we've been told there's nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. You know, the election still would have played out the way that it did. But at the same time, for us to be this late getting information of this scale saying, hey, it was twice as big as we thought, we don't really know how widespread yeah. it was. We don't really know everything that happened. It would be nice if there were more of a public dialogue around this. It would be nice if there were more transparency or urgency from our elected officials to say, okay, let's find out what really happened here.
Right.
No one's trying to change the results of the election or undo what's been done. But, you know, this is something that is very likely going to happen again. So to fully protect our electoral system, to fully understand what happened, it's, you know, that's what we need. And it doesn't seem like we can really protect ourselves, our elections process, if we don't fully understand what happened and what the ramifications of that were.
Right. Now, remember, there have been allegations that voting machines and voting networks have been vulnerable for the better part of a decade and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was always, there was so little political will to mm-hmm. do anything about it because, well, sure, maybe someone, if they did this, this, and this, and had access to that, maybe they could do something.
Yeah.
But there was never a smoking gun. Folks, this is a smoking gun. And you know, I'm sorry, and actually I can say this because I'm not normally a host on TNT, but You should care about this. This, it doesn't matter what party you voted for. It doesn't matter what your politics are. This is democracy in this country being undermined. And whether or not it actually changed the outcome of the election is immaterial. What is important is the fact that it's even possible. And it possible on this scale, 39 states, everybody should be worried about this. Everyone should be writing to your representative and saying, hey, do something about this.
Yeah.
And that do something can be anything. We've got people in the chat room saying, go back to paper ballots. Okay. Or go to a more secure electronic voting network. That's fine too. But to say it will probably be okay next time is that, not an option.
Yeah, that would be frankly irresponsible. You know, there are problems. There are solutions. In order to go find the solutions, you have to know what the problems are. So go through the process, and that's what's necessary. So it doesn't seem like it's a story that's going to go away.
Nope.
And we'll see if there is any political will to do anything about it.
Yay.
Well, a 30-year-old man in Pakistan named Taimur Raza has been sentenced to death for committing blasphemy in posts on Facebook and WhatsApp in a first for the country. Amnesty International says this is, quote, the harshest handed down yet for a cybercrime-related offense, end quote. Raza inadvertently ended up in a conversation with a government official on Facebook. His brother told The Guardian, quote, my brother indulged in a sectarian debate on Facebook with a person who he later came to know was a counterterrorism official, end quote. It's unclear exactly what was written in these posts, but Raza was charged under a law that outlaws insulting the Prophet Muhammad, which is punishable by death. This is a first.
Yes.
And it's definitely getting a lot of blowback from human rights groups, from online freedom groups, a lot of different advocacy groups. Yeah, Amnesty International, and also Human Rights Watch. It's disturbing and interesting.
Well, you know, the truly disturbing thing for me, because I understand the laws. I've visited many of these countries where these things happen, and you have to be aware of what you can and cannot do.
Yeah.
That's part of being a visitor to a country. What's scary, though, is the fact that this is now encroaching on social media, and as we all know, social media is disjointed. You very rarely get a full conversation. You very rarely can understand the nuances, the back and forth of an exchange.
Yeah.
So if suddenly you can sentence someone to death for a single post on Facebook or Twitter without looking at the rest of their posts to say, oh, this was a rhetorical device that he was using to try to make his point, that is a huge precedent in the absolute wrong way.
Yeah, it's pretty scary in lots of different ways. A lot of the advocacy groups that are condemning this decision are pointing out that, you know, these sorts of things could be misinterpreted, could be falsified, and could be used to oppress certain groups, whether it's minority groups, religious minority groups, government, people who are, you know, against government decisions, all sorts of different ways to misuse these sorts of laws. This sentence was actually handed down by an anti-terrorism court and not a regular court, which has been pointed to as a red flag here as well.
Yeah. There's also the issue of impersonation, because right now we don't have a really good way to verify that someone is actually who they say they are on social media.
Yeah.
And the fact that they basically railroaded this guy. This was not a long trial. This was, oh, here's the printout of what he said. Oh yeah, that's punishable by death. I mean, how easy is that to abuse? How easy is it to abuse someone of saying something against the Prophet Muhammad or whatever your sacred cow might be?
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're in trouble because they've left a trail on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, this is shocking, and obviously this is wrong. I will say, yes, it is wrong. And obviously none of us in a Western system would consider this, but it is very troubling. This should stay on people's threat scopes.
Yeah, lawyer with the Human Rights Watch, his name is Sarup Iljaz, said such sentences will embolden those who want to wrongly frame people, and the confusion between national security and religion is very alarming. And I think that kind of hits on the points that you just made. Well, a quick reminder that you can comment on anything we discuss by emailing tnt@twit.tv, and of course, definitely come and subscribe to Tech News Today by going to our show page at twit.tv/TNT. After the break, Mike Murphy from Quartz is here to talk about why Google is killing off the cutest thing it's ever made. Aww. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron, the sponsor of this episode. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals in 40 minutes or less. And by shipping the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and they deliver to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. You can customize your recipes every week based on your own dietary preferences, and you can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Upcoming meals include warm smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons, spiced zucchini enchiladas and creamy lime and tomato rice, elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice, peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. All that stuff sounds great. And I got to say, I am a subscriber.
I'm hungry now.
I've ordered about half those things, so I'm looking forward to getting those on my front door. You can check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/TNT. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Since 2014, some adorable self-driving cars called Fireflies have been cruising around Silicon Valley. Google built these cars with their self-driving car unit, Waymo, and now Waymo is officially killing off these koala-looking coupes. Mike Murphy from Quartz is here to tell us the full story. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is going on? Why is Google killing the most adorable thing it's ever made?
It's such a bummer. I just, they're so cute. I really do love them. The reason they're doing it is because, you know, they always said from the get-go that these were always just intended to be kind of prototypes. You know, they were building themselves to kind of figure out where sensors should go and that sort of thing. And they always said, always from the get-go, that their intention was always to partner with, you know, people that have been making cars for forever. And that's exactly what they've been doing. Their first partnership has been with Chrysler. And so they're replacing these adorable little cars that, like, to me, kind of just speak of the future. They look just like what you'd want the future to look like. And they're replacing them with minivans.
Oh, minivans. The worst. Everyone in the studio just went, oh.
Just a collective groan. But you know, at 2 years ago at Google I.O., they had the koalas right in front of the press room. And it was fun to take a look at them. And we actually got to go in and play with some of the tech. Mm-hmm. And I was speaking to one of the engineers and I asked why this design. I mean, I actually like it, but it's different.
It's real different. Yeah. No steering wheel, no nothing. Dashboard.
It provokes a conversation. And what he said was, look, this is not just something that holds the technology. We want people to realize that if you're designing a self-driving car, all the rules are different. It doesn't have to look like the cars we've known for the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my question to you, Mike, is that what Google did? They gave us the crazy concept, and now it's sort of like, okay, now here's something you might actually want to buy.
I mean, I think it's a fair assessment in terms of it being a concept. You know, it's the same way that every car company comes out with concepts that are crazy futuristic. And then, like, you know, in like 10 years, 5 years, we start to actually see what was originally a concept becoming something you actually can buy. I think that's entirely possible with this. You know, I personally don't see Google or Waymo making any kind of car themselves anytime soon, but they're definitely kind of showing, like, you know, through the partnerships that we want to foster, this is the sort of thing that we're envisioning for the future. It's just kind of a shame that they kind of had the future here. Like, usually concept cars don't really do anything. These cars really were picking people up and, you know, really could drive you around. And you know, in a very limited capacity, drive on their own. And, you know, they're taking that away and replacing it with literally the car of soccer moms is kind of a bummer design wise. But, you know, if it's a better car, if it's a better self-driving car, then that makes sense, at least for now.
So where are these cars going to go? Do they have plans? Are they going to, like, you know, destroy them all? Or are they going to keep them somewhere? What's going to happen?
I just don't think you could actually, like, kill those little koalas. I mean, that would just be inhumane. They're sending them out to design museums and other tech museums around the world. So near their home, there's going to be one at the tech museum in San Jose, I think it is. And then there's going to be one in the London Design Museum, which is pretty cool. That's a brand new building, and I really want to go, and it'll fit right in there. I think there's actually one already there. You know, they've slowly been seeding these out and getting rid of them and replacing them with their minivans.
I think they should save a few and auction them off at the next Google I.O. They could make a lot of money. I mean, seriously, I would love to have one, even if I could never drive it on the street.
Yeah.
Just to have it would look incredible. Now, I'm glad you brought up partnerships, because this has become something that's very important for specifically the Silicon Valley trying to get into self-driving cars. At CES this year, we dropped by the Ford booth, and one of the things that the Ford executive was saying was he doesn't think a lot of these Silicon Valley companies realize how difficult it is to develop an automobile versus a consumer electronic product, that there's so much regulation, there's so much safety you have to build in from the get-go. You can't really do that beta thing that we do in the Silicon Valley. What are the strategic partnerships that you see Google making, and what partnerships are left? Who do they have to bring in to make the Firefly actually usable?
I mean, I think partnering with someone like Fiat Chrysler, you know, one of the oldest, biggest car companies in the world, is exactly that. You know, that is a move of, we know that, you know, the old adage everywhere is hardware is hard, and it's a lot harder when you have to, like, pass road safety standard tests and have stuff be durable for tens of thousands of miles and winters in Canada and summers in Brazil, you know, and it's the same car. That's not exactly the same as making your iPhone work in good weather. So I think by partnering with manufacturers that obviously have been doing this for a while, they're going to get a lot closer. I honestly think that some of the partnerships we don't know about yet, because those companies might not even exist yet. You know, it's hard to say what they need exactly for an industry that doesn't entirely exist. Like in my mind, you know, the kind of systems that a lot of these companies are using, not necessarily Google, but a lot of companies pursuing self-driving cars with, like, LiDAR, you know, that's a technology that has basically been foisted onto these cars because it kind of works and it's kind of giving them the vision that they need to be able to perceive the world. But that's only because that's what existed right when they started this project. You know, it's the same spinning buckets that have been on these cars since the first self-driving cars, like 15 years ago. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the best. I think what we're going to see is a lot more fundamental research being turned into startups, being turned into acquisitions over the next 10 years. Like, we're at the point where we're sort of just about getting to a minimum viable product of a self-driving car. We're nowhere near what you need for every aspect of the car for you know, commercial or kind of fleet use yet.
I like that point that some of the technology and the partnerships that they need to find don't actually exist yet. You're absolutely right. The spinning LiDAR balls that we've grown so accustomed to seeing, I think the first time that they were used on a vehicle was during the DARPA Grand Challenge, where they had to create a self-driving vehicle. And they had the huge military versions. They've come down in size and price, but
kind of an eyesore design-wise to the top of a car. Like, you know.
And it's not really tenable because you can't have a moving device on a production vehicle that needs to stay mobile and undamaged. You're going to destroy them, and then suddenly your self-driving car becomes a non-driving car with no steering wheel. You're right. I think over the next couple of years, they're going to start to see these quantum leaps in the technology that actually enable self-driving cars. And those are the partnerships that Google is going to have to make.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think on that, you know, one of the kind of misconceptions, especially with LiDAR, is that just because these things are getting smaller, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's, like, a Moore's law effect happening here.
Right.
The, you know, Velodyne, the company that makes a lot of these LiDAR systems, still makes the really big one, that one has 64 channels of lasers, 64 lasers going across at all times, whereas the little ones only have 16 lasers. And it's not necessarily any more efficient. That's why you see a lot of the newer self-driving car prototypes out there. They'll have like five or six of those little ones. And then the older ones might have one big one. The difference is they're using five or six little ones to get the same resolution that that one big one had. And the cost savings ends up being relatively minimal.
You know, Mike,
so that's not really a tenable situation, you know?
Yeah. Earlier in the show, we were talking about Apple and their efforts in the self-driving car arena. And one of the things that they want to do is they want to focus on the AI, because there's this idea that if you develop the AI, then you know what technology to develop for the sensors. Is that the right way to go? Because right now we take the sensors that we have and we develop AI around them. Apple wants to do a different approach. They say, look, what's the best way to make decisions? That's the technology we should be developing to give that AI eyes, ears, etc.
I mean, I think it's a fair way to approach a problem that's different than how other people are approaching it. I don't necessarily know if one is right or wrong. I would say that, you know, whether you're taking this kind of chicken and egg approach to it of like, we don't know what we need because it doesn't exist yet. It's hard to do that. And I think the reason that a lot of these companies are doing what they have done is like, well, we know this technology exists. Let's get some kind of thing working and then move on from there. But I do think that one of the problems is that it's not just necessarily being able to sense things. It's being able to perceive what you're sensing. And we've gotten pretty good at sensing things and knowing that objects are in front of us, but we don't necessarily know what those objects are all the time going 80 miles an hour on a freeway or less, because the speed limit is never that high. But you know what I mean? Of like, it's hard to know. We haven't necessarily got the models yet for every possible situation. And I don't know necessarily if the right way to do that is to have just better sensors or better AI that actually just knows what it's perceiving from low quality information.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Mike, for joining us. Yeah, you made a great comparison to the little Tykes Cozy Coupe, the pedal car for kids in your story. That was pretty spot on as far as the styling of the Firefly. Rest in peace, Firefly. Rest in peace, Koala Car.
Aww.
This is so sad. but thanks as always for joining us. So people can find you and your reporting on Course's website, QZ.com, and on Twitter at MCWM, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's me.
All righty. Cool. We'll let you go, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me.
You know, if Google wants to give us one of the koalas, we'll keep it in our lobby.
You know, I like that. I think we should call up, Larry and Sergey after the show, and
I could use it as my office. Interested. That would be awesome. I just sit in that, chill out.
Be the most adorable office of all time.
I had a conversation with a Google engineer about this, and he was saying, well, one of the issues that they deal with is humans are typically slow to perceive, but quick to make a connection. So in other words, I may not be able to notice everything around me immediately, but when I do notice it, my brain works in such a way that I can pretty quickly figure out what it is.
Yeah.
AI is the opposite. It is very fast to know when something is around it, but it's very slow to make
to
that
recognize
connection.
What it is.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what we're fighting.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, next up, folks, we need to take a look at the fan of the day. And today's fan of the day is Noble Bleekerson, who listens to Twit while driving thanks to his Android Wear watch. Noble says Twit helps him get through his traffic jams in style, may I add. Brian, you've got a custom face on your watch just like that, right?
I did until it died. Yeah, as much as I would like to use my, it was an original Moto 360. Does not survive.
The original Moto 360 had some of the nicer design. I feel like the early Android Wear watches were the best looking, although maybe not the most capable.
I had Leo's original Moto 360 until I realized it wasn't as waterproof as I thought it was.
And then it was
Moto. I have come to the realization that was entirely my fault. Well, folks, that's our fan of the day. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag, #HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
Well, Microsoft's biggest news at E3 was a $500 Xbox. That is the most powerful console ever. PlayStation has a ton of exclusives on the way, including an eagerly anticipated Spider-Man game. But Nintendo seems to have won over pretty much the entire internet, with all the E3 chatter online today being focused around Super Mario Odyssey, its upcoming game for the Switch, and kind of maybe how weird it might be. In this game, Mario places his hat on a person, a frog, a dinosaur, pretty much anything, and then he can then control their bodies. And whomever he's possessing at the moment gets a Mario mustache. This is
creepy,
hilarious, it's and weird creepy. And kind of creepy at the same time. But I think it's going to make Halloween costumes a lot easier, because then you just put on a hat and a mustache and you're good to go. You don't have to do anything else. But Padre, we played the Switch this weekend on new screensavers. Yes. With arms and the motion control, you'll be able to flick a Joy-Con, and that's kind of how it'll
throw
work.
The hat.
Yeah, and that'll throw the hat.
But wait,
at least that's what the reports are
saying. What if Mario as a person doesn't actually exist? Maybe he's always been his hat.
What?
Okay.
You're blowing my mind.
Mind blown.
He's always been like a floating mustache and a hat, and then the guy that's been there has not even been Mario the whole time.
Man, he's been possessed for 30 years.
I can't handle this. That is insane. This poor plumber from like New Jersey or something like that that's been taking all these adventures against his will. That is insane. Oh my.
Folks, here on TNT, that's right. We're busting the top off the truth. Mario is some sort of demon.
He's basically like a succubus or something like that.
He's a Nintendibus. He's a Nintendibus demon. So you can take over this dinosaur.
Yeah. And look, there's a little, I don't know if you can see, there's a little mustache. The dinosaur had a mustache at the time. Yeah. So Nintendo also showed off some trailers for some new Metroid games, two of them, in fact. Some downloadable content for Zelda, a new Yoshi game, a new Kirby game. But this is the one that everyone's talking about. This is the one I want to play the most. And it's also the one that's a little bit the most unnerving.
You know, looking at this and playing Arms with you, honestly, it might be time for me to get a Switch. I have
That's what I like to hear, Padre.
I have not bought a platform since the Xbox, the Xbox 360.
Yeah.
So it might be time for me to get back in.
You're overdue.
This does look kind of fun. I have to say, even you know,
there's an old you can go
like Paper Mario 2D, thing going on.
Yeah, 3D. It's gonna. It looks like there's just a ton of levels. Like we could spend hours and hours and hours playing this. And then see, he goes into the hat. And the frog had a mustache.
They could have some sort of Dragon Ball Z Ginyu Squad thing here where he accidentally throws his hat on the wrong thing.
That could be bad. That could be, see? And then you know, the possessed Mario body goes into the hat.
Would you want to take over a bullet bill? I mean, because you explode, right?
I wonder if they'll let you take over anything like GTA style so you can
he took over a turret.
For the game. Yeah.
He just took over an electrical spark?
Yeah, I don't. The possibilities are endless. It looked like he was eating dirt. I'm not sure.
Okay.
All right. Well, that is insane.
That does it. Folks, don't forget that TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leaving us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also hit us up on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
You can share your thoughts on the stories we discuss in the TNT subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can find all the ways to subscribe to our shows, this show, all the Twit shows at twit.tv, and for this one specifically, twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm on Twitter at NateOG.
And you can find me at PadreSJ. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burke, for helping out in the studio and fixing my teleprompter, Kevin for editing our show, and thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you tomorrow here on TNT.